It is Friday, August the 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, Mananago wins, barely though, Zimbabwe's presidential election.
Nelson Chamisa, the opposition challenger, who lost by a very narrow margin, said earlier tonight that he plans to challenge the result.
Have negotiations with Turkey to release a U.S. pastor hit a snag.
I think the way it should be looked about is that this is the culmination of basically long-term efforts to try and get this man, Pastor Andrew Brunson, released.
And Apple making some trillion-dollar history, plus the sounds of a 12-year-old YouTube social media sensation. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa has won his country's presidential race by a small margin over the main challenger, Nelson Chamisa. VOA's Lori London asks Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell if the election results will be challenged.
Yes, definitely this result will be challenged. That was evidenced by an uninvited guest who identified himself as the spokesman for opposition challenger Nelson Chamisa, and he said these results are fake. His issue was he said that the results have not been verified by party polling agents. This is a technical issue, but nevertheless a very important one and part of the process of vote counting. So what the opposition MDC Alliance is claiming is that there were irregularities and their polling agents have different numbers than the official count.
So ultimately, what were the final results? What was the count?
Ultimately, incumbent President Emmerson Mnangagwa has won the election, but it's worth noting that it was by a razor thin majority. It was by a razor thin margin, rather. He won with 50.8% of the vote, which is just enough legally for him to take office without a runoff, because in order to win the presidential election in Zimbabwe, you have to win 50% of the vote plus one vote. And 50.8% is just over that line. He won the vote with a total of 2,460,463 votes, which is just over half, but just by a hair.
So we've already established that it will definitely be challenged, but in a race like this, when it is that close, do they automatically do a recount like they would here in the U.S.?
So Nelson Chamisa, the opposition challenger, who lost by a very narrow margin, said earlier tonight that he plans to challenge the result. But he was very clear that he plans to challenge the result in a legal, constitutional, and peaceful manner. So he will likely try to challenge the election, demand a recount, demand a second look at the numbers, and maybe have some questions about the process. So we can look forward to that in the days, weeks, or however long it takes. And that will likely be a very controversial, very closely watched, very detailed, very rumor-filled process that will probably really unsettle people even further. What is interesting is that in the capital, in Harare province, which is one of the 10 provinces in the country, Nelson Chamisa, the opposition challenger, pounded Emmerson Mnangagwa. He won 548,889 votes compared to Mnangagwa's 204,710 votes. And that's going to really lead to some interesting politics going forward, because it's very clear that the people in the capital who make the most noise, who are the most visible, did not want Emmerson Mnangagwa as their president.
Right, a long-time Mugabe supporter. Maybe it would seem they are looking for a fresh start.
Well, that's another interesting thing. So Mugabe came out and coyly, kind of passive-aggressively, and I think that's fair to say, passive-aggressively endorsed Chamisa, because he says he cannot vote for ZANU-PF after what they did to him. He characterized his departure as an outright coup. So that's the that's the wrench in the system here, that Mugabe was actually pretty much endorsing Chamisa. So it is worth noting that in Mugabe's home province, the last province to be announced, of Mashonaland West, Mnangagwa won that province with 312,000 votes, but Chamisa followed with 217,000 votes. It wasn't maybe as wide of a margin as maybe was expected. One wonders how much the Mugabe effect took hold in Mashonaland West.
Given the violence and given the violence that we have seen over this deepening political crisis in the past week, I know it's early there. Have you seen any indication that there could be more outbreaks?
Well, at this very moment, as I said, it's the earliest hours of Friday, and the streets of Harare are very, very quiet. What's worth noting is that on Wednesday night, the police said that they'd invoked the Public Order and Security Act, which basically gives the police the authority to call in the army to help restore order. And that's, you know, quite a big thing and quite intimidating to a lot of Zimbabweans. So today and a little bit on Wednesday also, we saw army armored personnel carriers in the streets. We saw soldiers in the streets. This evening, as I was coming on my way to the election announcement, I saw groups of soldiers roaming the streets, patrolling perhaps, roaming perhaps, who knows. And that's very intimidating, and that is sure to diminish enthusiasm for many people who might be inclined to go protest. I mean, it's quite a deterrent. More importantly, we asked Nelson Chamisa a few hours ago whether he would call his people to the streets, and he gave a very enigmatic answer. He said, "I can hardly call my people to take to the streets when my people are homeless and jobless, and they already live on the streets, and the streets are their home." So he didn't say yes or no. He just kind of deflected that question. But he has stressed that he's going to challenge this legally and constitutionally, not through protest. He hasn't mentioned that yet, specifically.
That is Anita Powell, as VOA Southern Africa correspondent. She was speaking from Harare, Zimbabwe, with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Up next, the U.S. Special Counsel's Office indicts 12 Russian military officers with conspiring to interfere with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. We'll examine the latest in the Russia probe and analyze what, if anything, federal and state governments are doing to secure the 2018 midterm elections from malign Russian interference. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Addition. Tensions between NATO members and the United States and Turkey have met Washington sanctions of two senior Turkish officials over the continuing detention of American Protestant pastor Andrew Brunson on terrorism and espionage charges. Atlantic Council resident senior fellow Aaron Stein tells VOA's Victor Beatty there reportedly have been negotiations to resolve the matter, but they appear to have hit a snag.
I think the way it should be looked about is that this is the culmination of basically long-term efforts to try and get this man, Pastor Andrew Brunson, released. And if you are to believe the reporting on this, there was a Turkish reneging on the deal at the last minute, which prompted an escalatory cycle that resulted in these two men being sanctioned.
Is this a matter of internal politics in Turkey for the delay?
I mean, it's really unclear. Clearly something broke down to where negotiations with the United States ultimately became inconclusive, and that, you know, basically after 2 years of this, this administration in particular has personalized this issue. They've made the release of Pastor Brunson a top priority and are looking to gain leverage to try and bring him home.
Is there any indication Brunson is in fact involved in some illegal activity in Turkey?
If you can read Turkish and you can look at the indictment, it's farcical. So that doesn't preclude him from having run afoul of the law, although the indictment is so poorly written, full of typos, screwing up denominations of Christianity in the United States and alleging, of all things, PKK involvement. It seems fair to say that it is politicized and probably not up to American standards.
Is he really just a pawn in this whole issue of the Fethullah Gulen extradition case?
My personal hypothesis, and it's a hypothesis because nobody knows the entire facts, is they sort of stumbled into this. He was picked up by an overzealous police officer where he lives in Turkey as he was renewing his residency permit, and things sort of escalated from there. And so, yes, he has become a pawn, but largely by accident, comedy of errors on all sides.
Turkey, of course, has objected to the sanctions. They only affect two officials, though. Is this going to have a big problem for Turkey? The lira did hit an all-time low against the dollar.
I mean, I think the general economic downturn is the biggest problem for Turkey. The risk of escalatory cycle with the United States, presuming Turkey retaliates and puts sanctions on, what would be the equivalent, you know, the Attorney General and the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, just makes investors nervous. It will help depreciate the lira well beyond sort of the immediate economic consequences of these sanctions, which are just limited to these two men.
Given what's going on in Syria and, of course, Turkey's stronger ties with Russia, how would you characterize U.S.-Turkish relations?
They're in a downward spiral. I mean, we haven't hit rock bottom, clearly, because I expect the Turks to retaliate. And this pastor hasn't been released, and the vice president has indicated that the American side will escalate if there isn't movement from the Turkish side. So somebody has to blink here, you know, and until that happens, it's hard to hit the reset button.
That is Atlantic Council resident senior fellow Aaron Stein speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program.
Apple is the world's first publicly traded company to be valued at $1 trillion. That milestone marks the latest triumph of a trend-setting company that was started by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak 42 years ago. VOA's David Byrd asked investment advisor Harley Kaplan of Beta Industries in Plymouth, Massachusetts, what is his read on the importance of this milestone.
Well, David, if you asked me 35 years ago when I first started if we would have $1 trillion companies, I don't think I would have believed that. But now it has happened. The glass ceiling has been broken, and the laws of supply and demand will now dictate the future. And there will be other companies that will be worth $1 trillion.
I understand that Amazon is hot on the heels of Tim Cook and Apple. Jeff Bezos' company is just a couple of hundred million behind the, or a couple of hundred billion, rather, behind the $1 trillion mark itself.
Yes, and looking at their trajectory, it would seem that they will also be closing in on the $1 trillion mark just because of their capacity to grow and the different markets that they're looking to grow into.
Other than an emotional boost, what does this mean for Apple as a company and for consumers who might want to buy their products?
It doesn't really mean much for consumers who want to buy their product unless Apple becomes really a true giant dominating the field. So long as there's competition in the field, prices will be held to reasonable levels, and consumer will benefit from this. Because not only does Apple have the capacity to grow domestically, it has the capacity to grow internationally, but it also has the capacity to grow in innovation. And that's really what it comes down to. Is the consumer going to benefit in the long run? Innovation will help the consumer, but so will competition.
Now, Apple has hung its fortunes on the iPhone for going on 11 years now, while the iPad seems to have faded from view. Tim Cook, very shrewdly, though Apple is selling fewer units than it was early in the iteration of the iPhone, it still makes a profit. Now, why is that?
Well, their cost of production is so low. You know, a lot of their production is in China. Some of it is in Mexico. Some of it's actually dispersed throughout the world. It is the cost of the goods that really dictates the profits. And this is a high-margin profit, and it's a hard and it's a big seller for Apple. It's in big demand. It's the gold standard. There are some competitors. There's Samsung. But again, Apple seems to really hold the lead on this, and I don't see it relinquishing that lead for quite a while.
That leads into my next question. Could the blossoming trade war between the United States and China affect Apple's future? And what about increased tariffs on products from Canada, Mexico, and the EU?
That's a great question. And the reason why that's a great question, because Apple has a lot of production in China, has a lot of markets in China. I think at this point almost 20% of their sales are in China, and quite frankly, a lot of their growth is based upon the growth of the Chinese market. So they're really going to be affected by the trade issues that are being presented by Washington. But we need to keep that in context. The trade issue is a very serious issue. The theft of intellectual property is also a major concern for Apple. So this trade tariff, the debate that's going on between the countries, is a real important one. And we're going to need to see how it works out. But unlike Amazon, which most of their products, most of their sales are here in the United States, they're not really as affected as Apple is. So being a truly international company, Apple certainly has some future headwinds.
Now, what kind of influence do you think a trillion-dollar company like Apple or maybe Amazon or Microsoft will have on U.S. public policy?
You know, David, companies have had influences on governments and monarchies and for centuries. I'm in Plymouth, Massachusetts, so the London Stock Company funded the Pilgrims come over here. And as you know, Isabella funded Columbus to discover America. But more important, what we're seeing here is that companies are intertwined with politics, and they have to be, because all politics is local. And I'll give you a good example of that. A little while ago, Xi was the Prime Minister of China, was concerned about ZTE, which is his telecommunication company in China. And it's a company that's in his hometown. He made a big issue of dealing with that issue with President Trump and saying that, you know, we need to get access to your markets. So all politics is local, and the political parties are dominated by businesses. They have to be. They have to be. And even in communist China, businesses still dictate some of the terms.
Harley, have I left anything out of our discussion you think my audience needs to know?
Well, I think what your audience needs to know is that what we're looking at right now is a whole different paradigm. The markets, the stock market, has not really performed very well over the last 15 years. It had the credit crunch, which really takes a lot of wind out of its sails, and it's done so for about 10 years. We're now getting back to a normal. Unfortunately, the new normal was low GDP of 2%. Although we just had GDP go up to 4.1%, that really has not been the normal for the last 30 or 40 years. So we are looking at a slower economy than before, but picking up, and picking up incrementally. I do think that the market will, you know, we have two guarantees in our business. The market will go up and the market will go down. But eventually, as we're seeing now, 35 years from now, there'll be even bigger companies than $1 trillion.
Harley Kaplan, that is an investment advisor. He's with Beta Industries in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And he was speaking with VOA's David Byrd. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
There are some 19,000 white rhinos left in the world, mostly in South Africa, but their horns remain hot on the black market for poachers and hunters. Chris Gallers is the coordinator of Project Rhino, a group trying to preserve the life of the rhino by sawing off the horns before poachers do.
In terms of the rhino, we dehorn them and we try and reduce it as much as we can, even shaping the horns to take off all the edges, any valuable part that we can.
One rhino horn can fetch $100,000, and even though there's an international ban on rhino horns, demand is high in parts of Asia for the horns, especially in Vietnam, where it's believed the horn offers medicinal value. Another challenge, the horns grow back like fingernails after they're cut down by conservationists, which repeat the procedure each year at a cost of $1,200 per rhino. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. You know what? It's time now for a little something from the world of music.
Fly me to the moon, then let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars, and all the worlds hold my hand, and all the worlds, darling, kiss me.
12-year-old Angelina Jordan was invited by American musician and record producer Quincy Jones to sing Fly Me to the Moon at his 85th birthday concert in London. Angelina, who lives in Oslo, Norway, started singing at 1.5 years old and really hit the scene when she won the Norway's Got Talent competition at age 8 in 2014.
Thank you.
Angelina Jordan won Norway's Got Talent by singing classic jazz standards like Fly Me to the Moon. She's a big fan of jazz and the songs that make up the so-called American Songbook, songs like Cole Porter's Every Time We Say Goodbye, which she performed on Norway's TV2.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little. Every time we say
as I said earlier, Angelina lives in Oslo, Norway, there with her family. She's a pupil at the Oslo Waldorf School and also attends the after-school program at the Oslo School of Music and Performing Art, where she receives vocal training. In addition to singing, she plays the piano, violin, and flute.
Begin to sing about it.
Angelina Jordan is a YouTube and social media sensation, and sometimes she covers contemporary artists like Lana Del Rey, the American singer and songwriter, singing here, Young and Beautiful.
I've seen the light on it all, and my cake now. Diamonds brilliant and violet now. But summer nights in July, when you and I went forever wild. Crazy days, city lights, the way you play with me like a child. Will you still love me when I'm no longer young and beautiful? Will you still love me when I got nothing but my aching soul? I know you will, I know you will.
In 2015, Angelina Jordan published the book Mellum Tohukter, illustrated by her artist grandmother, Mary Zamani. The book tells the story of Angelina's meeting with a poor, motherless girl in Asia to whom Angelina gives her shoes. In return, the girl promises to always pray for Angelina. According to Angelina, the book is based on a real incident, and she cites it as the reason why she always performs barefoot.
Summer days, rock and roll. The way you play for me and you show, and all the ways I got to know your pretty face, an electric song. Will you still love me when I'm no longer young and beautiful? Will you still love me when I got nothing but my aching soul? I know you.
And I have to tell you, there's plenty more of Angelina Jordan out there on YouTube and social media. You really should check out. Beautiful, beautiful voice. By the way, her music is also available for downloading on sites such as iTunes. Angelina Jordan. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday. Now some more from Angelina Jordan.
Is my son, he makes me shine like a diamond. Hey, you still love me when I'm no longer young and beautiful. Hey, you still love me when I got nothing but my aching soul. I know you will, I know you will, I know.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As part of its efforts to combat HIV, the United States intends to provide up to $90 million to build secondary schools across Malawi and additional funding to provide youth-friendly health services. The U.S. signed a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, with Malawi in July to expand existing secondary schools and install new secondary schools throughout Malawi. In the MOU, the government of Malawi committed to fund training and salaries for teachers to staff the new schools and maintenance of the new structures. To support the provision of youth-friendly health services near secondary schools, to incorporate comprehensive sex education in the national curriculum to keep young people HIV-free, and to enact a phased-in reduction of secondary school tuition fees. Malawi's Minister of Education, Science and Technology, Bright Msaka, said, "I'm very excited to sign this Memorandum of Understanding on the expansion of secondary education. We are confident that this increased access to education will reduce the transmission of HIV to Malawi's youth and help us break the back of the HIV epidemic." Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Affairs Emmanuel Fabiano concurred, saying this will contribute to the sustainable socioeconomic development of Malawi. Through this commitment, the United States and Malawi will ensure more adolescent girls attend secondary school, which will better keep them HIV-free, said U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer. Studies have shown that for every year a girl attends secondary school, her risk of contracting HIV throughout her lifetime decreases. The first goal is to increase the number of classrooms in urban secondary schools across Malawi. Malawi's program will demonstrate the critical link between girls' education and public health for the rest of Africa and the world, and provide important benefits for Malawi's development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.